You're listening to the Think Christian podcast, where we like to say there is no such thing as secular, even in popular culture. I'm Josh Larson, editor at thinkchristian.net, host of this show, and Quentin Tarantino skeptic. I'll get to that more in a bit. First, I want to consider redemption. This is one of the big church words, very commonly used. But what do we mean when we say someone or something has been redeemed? Well, in the Reformed tradition, redemption refers to one of the four events in God's grand story. You've got creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. We're living in between those last two events right now, Christ's redemptive work on the cross and his ushering in of the new creation. So we have been redeemed, yet as fallen creatures awaiting that new creation, we still struggle to live into that. We've turned, we're heading in the right direction, we have our redemptive moments, but we still stumble along the way. There's a lot more to say about redemption, but that will suffice for now. It gives us a starting place to consider how redemption has played out in the work of Quentin Tarantino. Indeed, redemption is one of the big words for Christians who do appreciate his work and like to defend it as having redemptive value. J.R. Forresteros is going to talk about that with me in the context of Tarantino's new film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Then Sarah Welch Larson will join me to talk about redemption and another prickly pop culture figure, Aziz Ansari. After sexual misconduct allegations were made against him in early 2018, the comedian and actor kept a low profile for a bit. Now, though, he's returned, he's been on a stand-up tour, and he has a new Netflix special right now. Can it be considered a work of redemption? Sarah is going to help me try and answer that. If you found these conversations we've been having on the TC podcast fruitful, would you mind leaving a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts? Doesn't take long. Maybe you can even hit pause a moment and do us that favor before I talk to JR about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. JR Forresteros is joining me, and JR, I'm going to need you to identify yourself. Are you a Quentin Tarantino acolyte, skeptic, or detractor? Where do you stand on QT if you had to choose one of those?
Probably somewhere between skeptic and detractor. I feel like I don't get Tarantino because I think some of his movies are fine and some of them are problematic, and I haven't found one that I truly love. But many of the people that are film friends of mine love him, and I feel like I don't get it.
Okay. Yeah, definitely a cinephile favorite. I'm going to say for myself, I'm probably more of a skeptic. Absolutely, things that I find thrilling about his films and the craft he brings to them and the energy, all of that I'm certainly into. I do think his movies have this instinct for giddy violence.
Yeah.
That I have a tough time reconciling. I think for me, I don't know that these movies have the moral imagination to really interrogate or question that instinct for violence that they have. That's where I struggle a little bit. And actually, I think the movies where he's tried to do that, something like Inglourious Basterds or Hateful Eight, are where I see the gap most between the moral imagination and what's on the screen. So I do know not only cinephiles who love Tarantino, but Christian cinephiles in particular revere his work. And a lot of times they say they appreciate it because they find threads of redemption in it, even amidst the cruelty and the violence. It's sounding like for you, that hasn't been a very obvious thing when it comes to his previous films up till now. It hasn't been something that necessarily jumps out at you?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think about something like Inglourious Basterds, which kind of, I think, famously caught everyone off guard with its reimagination of the end of World War II and telling this completely fictitious, intentionally fictitious story where we got Hitler, you know, and he didn't ignominiously commit suicide in a bunker somewhere. And, you know, it felt like we got to get him. And in many ways, Hateful Eight or Django Unchained were the same kind of thing. There was this like individualized comeuppance that was meted upon the perpetrators of systemic violence like American racism in both of those films.
Yeah.
I don't think that's redemption.
Okay. More revenge fantasy?
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, I think your comment about his lack of moral imagination is exactly why. Yeah, does it feel good in the moment to watch us get Hitler? Of course it does, because of what he did on a global scale. Does it feel good to watch a plantation owner get what's coming to him? Of course it feels good because of the kinds of violence, but it also lets us keep those things at arm's length and deny maybe the continuing effects of those in our contemporary world. And ultimately, we also know that they didn't really happen that way. Yeah. So
yeah, it still is in the realm of fantasy in that
way. Yeah, it feels good, but it feels good in a way that, I don't know, maybe like a romantic comedy feels good.
Okay. Yeah, I think that sounds right to me when it comes to those films. The other place I hear redemption used a lot is in Pulp Fiction when it comes to Jules, the Samuel Jackson character, the hitman who makes a bit of a character transition from the beginning of the film to the end of the film. And for me, that's definitely there. I guess this is why I place myself as a skeptic. It almost seems like plotting more than an intrinsic, deeply held theme to that film. It's very neat. It's a nice bookend, but I don't know how much it actually says at the end of that movie. But as I mentioned, others find it to be very meaningful, and that's the reason Pulp Fiction resonates so much for them. Let's get to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Tarantino's new film, which is set in 1969 Hollywood, and it centers on two fictional figures. So here we have a mixing of fiction and history again. In this case, fading TV star Rick Dalton, who's played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and Dalton's stuntman slash driver Cliff Booth, who's played by Brad Pitt. These are the two fictionalized, imagined characters. And then Tarantino places them against the backdrop of this Hollywood that's really been invaded by the 1960s. So there's new music in the air. There are new artistic voices, young filmmakers breaking their way into the studio system, rising young stars like Sharon Tate. And that's a name that's synonymous with being a victim in the Manson murders in Hollywood. Here, Margot Robbie plays Tate, and she's given a fuller life, I think, than that perception of her, even though the Manson family is another plot line that Tarantino weaves into this. So there's a lot going on in this film, JR. Some of it, I think, is familiar Tarantino stuff, the use of pop music. There's certainly violence. But for me, it also feels new in some ways. What did you make of the movie just in general?
You know, I thought it was such a strange tone for a film in 2019 to strike because it felt like it was glamorizing that sort of golden age of Hollywood without, as you mentioned about his other films, without interrogating it. So there was a trailer for one of Rick Dalton's movies where he's like mindlessly slaughtering Native Americans. And again, that's a trope of those Westerns that perpetrated a particular myth of American innocence that today I hope most of us would find morally reprehensible. And yet it was portrayed as like the good old days, you know? So I don't know, even the scene with Bruce Lee, I felt like was in some ways glamorizing this kind of like machismo of days gone by. And it was looking back at this era, which was certainly great for guys like Rick Dalton, but not really great for anyone else that didn't look like him. You know, and yet again, it wasn't interrogated in any meaningful way, even against the backdrop of Manson, who allegedly was trying to trigger a race war. You know, none of that was interrogated in any way. Instead, we just, you know, cussed at the dirty hippies a bunch and, you know, wanted to get back to the good old days.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is there. I've described the movie as being conservative, which is an odd phrase, an odd word for a Tarantino movie, but I think it's conservative in that longing for an earlier era where the rules were established, whatever those rules might be, and not questioned. And sounds like I'm going to say that I like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a lot more than you. It's actually one of my favorite Tarantino films, but it is that because it gave me a lot to wrestle with in ways that his other ones didn't. I see all that conservatism that's problematic in exactly the ways you laid out, but I also see some of it being nostalgic for a time when popular culture was something that had a more tactile element to it, and it was unified. Everyone knew the same songs, knew the same TV shows. You know, there was just kind of this shared community that seems to have disappeared in popular culture today. That seems kind of neutral to me to miss that sort of thing. But yes, you're right, to also put it within this framework where, boy, it feels like things were better when it was dominated by white males, for example. The Bruce Lee element, I think people are going to rightly question. He's played here by Mike Moe. But one way to read that is that he's one of these invading forces, right? Here's a non-white star that old Hollywood doesn't quite know what to do with. And he's definitely aligned in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Sharon Tate and this newer generation. So I do see all that there. I see that there are potential issues with it. But I also found this movie to be so leisurely and ruminative and just plain old thoughtful, which is a word I wouldn't describe any really many Tarantino moments before this, just thoughtful about the passing of time, the passing of eras, the changing of a career, the aging. I mean, this is Tarantino's 9th film, and it's made by someone who's gotten older and whose career, by his own claim, is almost at an end. He claims he's only going to make 10 films. So I did appreciate that ruminative element of it, even though I see how it also bleeds into this questionable conservatism that you're touching on. Yeah, I don't know if that makes sense to you.
So I think you're totally right about what he was ruminating on there, this idea that, you know, a career is coming to an end. But I'm curious what you thought he was saying, because the way I read it was sort of as an old guy crossing his arms and saying, you know, we did it better back in my day. There didn't seem to be an enthusiasm for passing the torch to a younger generation, for empowering people coming after him. I don't think we're spoiling it, right? But certainly the end of the movie seems to want to take us back to the good old days.
Yeah.
Rather than moving us forward.
Yeah. We shouldn't spoil the end, but I think you're right in describing it that way. Absolutely. And what's really challenging is that summation also involves the violence that we've come to associate with him, that this movie has largely otherwise eschewed, but it really comes back in that finale. And definitely the violence is in favor of the old guard, let's just say. It's hard to get into his mind. This is why he's a difficult filmmaker. And I think if you look at the evidence on the screen, I'm going to say the reason we're having trouble with this is that I don't know how much self-interrogation is going on as to why these things are up on the screen. And one example I'll give is there are two elements where characters specifically talk about violence in the media and the power it has on audiences or does not have. And I think both of those are dropped in almost as like little irritants for those people who find this something even worth talking about in his films, because they don't really lead to anything. It's almost like, I know this is a conversation around my film, so I'm going to drop this in here and let people kind of do with it what they may, but it's not really intrinsic to what I'm interested in making this movie. So I think it comes down to the fact that this conservatism, this longing for the old guard, and to be clear, you know, he grew up, I believe, in the 60s. So it's not like he was part of that creative old guard, the old Hollywood studio system, but it's what he knew as an entertainment consumer, as a movie watcher and a TV watcher. And so I think the nostalgia for that and the love for a time when genre was more valued. He's a genre guy, and the studio system used to thrive on that. You know, the love for those sorts of things, which again is neutral, gets mixed up with this conservatism that the old way also meant that certain people were excluded from participation. But I don't think he's necessarily arguing outright to return to that, because you look at the portrayal of Sharon Tate by Margot Robbie, who is part of the new generation, and I found it to be completely positive and enthusiastic and used as a counterpoint, really, as her star rises in good ways to Rick Dalton's star falling. And so in that sense, I don't know that it's a very clear either or. I think like so many of his films, it's a real mess, because I don't think the films themselves are spending a lot of time trying to figure it out. It's more just instinctual, guttural stuff up there on the screen that's so perfectly crafted that sometimes we think, well, it must have been intellectually thought out as well. I don't know that it always is. I think it's just he's so talented that the craft comes out that complete, but I don't know if the thematic and intellectual framework underneath it is as complete. So bringing up Rick Dalton kind of gets us back to this idea of redemption, I think, because I'm going to defend the movie a little bit in terms of where the idea of redemption might come into play here. But let me ask you first, before I jump in with where I see it, and maybe it's a quick answer you'll give me. What do Christians mean when we talk about redemption in movies? And then jump from there and let me know if you see redemption at work in any way in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's like the most explicit literal kind of redemption, which would be where someone actually finds Christ or enters into a relationship with God. Obviously, the vast majority of the time, that's not happening in a film. So we're maybe looking for more, are there places that we could point to that we could say, this is what a life with God looks like, or this is something that points us or orients our worldview towards Christ in a way that's meaningful and helpful. I found one particularly beautiful sequence of the film is when Rick is shooting his movie and he gets, I'm trying to be vague here, he gets acting advice from an unexpected source.
Yes. Yeah, I think we could talk about this in fair detail. Okay. It doesn't give too much away plot-wise, and it comes in about midway through the film.
Yeah, so he's taking this role in a, I'm not sure if it was a TV show or a film. I think it was a TV show, right?
Yeah, he's kind of been reduced to villain guest spots in more popular TV shows, and this is one of those.
Yeah, and so you can tell even from when he's in the makeup trailer that he's not used to having to act. He's kind of that guy that's just Rick Dalton wherever he goes. Mm. And even the character that he's become known as, you know, in the Bounty Hunter show that he was famous for, is just basically just Rick Dalton. And even the director says, I don't want Rick Dalton. I want this Caleb guy.
Yes.
And you can tell he doesn't really understand what that means until he sits on the porch and has this long conversation with a child who really ends up speaking into his spirit in some unexpected ways. And then when he goes in to do his scenes, you see him actually act for the first time. You see him sort of like understand this deeper level to his craft that he's never accessed before. And I thought that was a beautiful thing, you know, that this guy who is on the backside, on the downslope of his career, is actually discovering his career for the first time. And he's finding meaning and purpose in this thing that the experts are telling him is a sign of the end.
Yeah, that's the exact scene I wanted to talk about. So I'm glad you brought that up. I think there are a couple of elements of redemption here. It's not like this is going to turn Rick's career around and put him on a different trajectory, but it does orient him in a right direction, to use your description of redemption theologically. You know, having been redeemed in response, we can orient ourselves to live into that. And I think this redeems this moment, this single moment in his career. It also redeems the part that he's playing, maybe a little bit, makes more of it than it was written as. And yeah, it's a redemptive approach to his craft. That 8-year-old co-star played by Julia Butters, she is so great. She's like this method actor at this young age and is kind of telling him, like, you got to take this seriously, right? Like, here's what you should do to really bring a lot to the part. You're right. And that's what he actually does. You have a little bit of a different reading on his performance. Like, for me, I still found it kind of like hokey and over the top. But for me, what mattered is that he was invested in it. You know, she tells him it was the best acting I've ever seen in my whole life. And I think there's a little dig there by the fact that she's an 8-year-old ghost.
Right.
How much has she seen? But I think what we can both definitely agree on is, like, he's present, he's in the moment, he's giving it another level of conviction that he hasn't before in previous performances. And in that, I think it is, there's a little flicker of redemption there. It may not tie entirely into the film itself, where the movie ultimately goes, but I did find some in that moment.
I agree. I mean, I know so many Christians who want to be somewhere else. You know, they want to be married or not married. They want to have kids or not have kids, or they want to be in a different city or a different job or a different, you know, and they're constantly looking like away from their own circumstances instead of asking, like, what is God doing in the midst right here and right now? And how is God calling me to be present here? And I mean, that's what I heard in that scene with Rick, even though, again, there was no mention of Christ, but sure, it was just that reminder of, like, where you are is a gift and there's grace in the midst of that. And sometimes it takes a child to come along and call us to be attentive to that,
right?
You know?
Yep, definitely. Yeah. And I like thinking about when we look for redemption in movies as Christians, I like thinking about it that way as well. Like these models, these echoes that trigger the way we understand it theologically. It's not literally what's happening on the screen, but it does bring that to mind in what we do see. So before we finish up here, JR, let's play the ranking game a little bit, though, you know, okay, this may not matter as much to you if you're not quite as invested in Tarantino's work, but I'm curious, first of all, if you've seen all his films, and then if you have, where you would put Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
So I have not seen Death Proof or Jackie Brown, which I know most people have at the top of their list.
Oh.
So I know, I apologize for not doing my homework, but I would actually put this pretty high on my list. I mean, I thought it was incredibly well shot. I enjoyed, as you said, the leisurely pace of it with the kind of explosion at the end. I thought the acting was a lot of fun. Like, you could tell everyone was having fun. Just kind of turned it up to about 10 and a half. I'm trying to think back through everything. I mean, I would probably put this, it'd probably be in my top three. I really enjoyed Django a lot. And, you know, obviously Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs is pretty high for me. So you put out your Letterboxd ranking and this made it pretty high up there.
Yeah, I was, you know, just really surprised. I wouldn't say I've given up on him, but I did not care for The Hateful Eight at all, his last film. And I've got this as my third favorite right now after Pulp Fiction. And then I do have Jackie Brown at number one. So That is your assignment.
I've got homework. Okay, I've got homework.
I do think, given what you've said and the way you've talked about the things that, you know, have kind of held you back with him, I do think you'd resonate with Jackie Brown, certainly as much as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and maybe more. So watch that. But you also have a Think Christian assignment now. So I don't want Jackie Brown to get in the way. You're going to write about the Amazon series, The Boys, right? We were just about this. So after you've written that article, maybe,
Perfect. Then
check out Jackie Brown, if you don't mind.
I don't know.
That way it might be up at thinkchristian.net by the time this episode is available. So listeners can definitely look for that. I am looking forward to reading it myself.
Awesome. Thanks, Josh. It's always fun to be on.
You got it.
Rock and redemption. It might seem like rock is all about rebellion, and it often is, but even at its raunchiest, there's often a thread, like echoes of the prodigal saying, hey, I wonder how far I can wander and still find my way home. Hi, I'm John J. Thompson, and these days the very idea of redemption, whether something can even be saved, if something bad can be made into something good, or if something worthless can be exchanged for something of value. In these postmodern times, those very ideas are fodder for countless songs. That was a bit of Queen, taking their turn in the redemption sandbox from their 1980 album, The Game, the same record that gave us Crazy Little Thing Called Love and Another One Bites the Dust, with a song called, simply, Save Me. It is, of course, part of this episode's specially curated Spotify playlist, a batch of 22 songs that somehow capture, or at least play with, the idea of redemption. From the obvious, with a classic from Bob Marley and the Wailers, and one of my all-time favorites from World Party, a touchstone from the Beatles, and a really interesting posthumous duet from Johnny Cash and Sheryl Crow, to some less obvious choices, including tracks from Lissy, Linkin Park, Rivers, and New Kids on the Block. A little later in the show, you'll hear a bit of another song called Save Me, the one by Amy Mann from the incredible Magnolia soundtrack that still hasn't lost an ounce of its power after 20 years. You should know what to do by now. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify and hit play. And if you follow the latest episode playlist, you'll always have the newest one there in your browser. But you can also find each episode's batch listed separately under the Think Christian profile. Plus, we combine all the playlists into one massive archive, so you can listen to that as well. And as always, if you think of any great songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me, at John J. Thompson, and I will take your suggestions under advisement. That's it for now, but until next time, remember what Clive Barker said. Any fool can be happy. It takes a man with real heart to make beauty out of the stuff that makes us weep.
Sarah Welch Larson has covered it all for TC. She's written about music. She's written about Doctor Who, reality television, Avengers. Sarah, are you ready to talk something new? We're going to cover stand-up comedy a minute here.
I will do my best.
All right. Excellent. I think we should probably start by briefly laying the groundwork for why Aziz Ansari, whose new Netflix stand-up special is called Right Now, why he qualifies for this redemption-themed episode. Maybe that's what we're going to talk about, if he should qualify for this episode. In early 2018, a woman came forward to describe in detail a date she had with Ansari, which included sexual activity that she felt was not consensual. He offered a response, a public response, basically said he understood it to be consensual at the time and that he was, quote, surprised and concerned about her claims and that he did reach out to her directly afterward. I don't think we need to litigate all of that. I don't know that we're in a position to be able to, but I do think it's important to at least have that context as we consider Ansari's special. Is there anything you think we should add to that, Sarah?
I don't think so. He's been pretty quiet about the whole situation. And the woman who came forward also hasn't said anything since that initial accusation, post, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah. And he does bring it up, we should say, in Right Now, fairly early on, about 4 minutes in, briefly talks about the emotions he's felt in the past year or so, and then offers this. His quote is, I just felt terrible that this person felt that way. So already you can see kind of a distancing of himself in that wording. He also says that he hopes it made other people, quote, be more thoughtful, and talks about the way he feels like he's become a more thoughtful person in the aftermath. It's interesting because just before that, it's what you would expect, a very high energy, excited welcome to the crowd. But this, he becomes really hushed and really still, almost whispers a lot of this. And I guess it's meant to be intimate and genuine, but to me, it sounded hesitant and perhaps even obligatory in a way. How did you take it though, Sarah?
That is exactly how I felt about it too. And I think the thing that I noticed the most was how he was so focused on how he felt throughout all of the accusations and on how he felt throughout the past year. And other than saying, I felt terrible that I made this other person feel bad, it was more about his own feelings of turmoil than it was about any pain that he might have caused somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't bring the woman's experience very much into the conversation. And I think that's why this whole special is worth taking with a grain of salt and realizing that we are very much getting his perspective on this. I do think as it went on, it kind of settled into a more regular rhythm that I'm familiar with from his previous performances. And I do think it gets maybe a little bit more confessional, or maybe I should say there's some more potentially redemptive stuff that takes place around the edges of this particular topic. Once he gets away from the topic itself, when he's talking about other subjects, I think it started for me when he brings up, I guess you could call it woke culture, and how we're spending a lot of time now digging stuff up from the past and then pointing out how insensitive it seems today. And he mentions, in particular, a Parks and Recreation episode. So the show he was on, and there was a plot line that involved a nanny cam. I myself don't remember it, though I watched that whole series. And he says that if that was presented to him now, if he was still on the show, he wouldn't agree to go forward with it because he feels, again, he's become more thoughtful in some ways and thought about such things a little bit differently. And the quote he has here is kind of interesting. He says, we're all bleep people. We have our blind spots and we become aware and we become better people. So to me, that starts to suggest a learning, growth, change. And I think it also maybe speaks to the title of the special, which is Right Now, and sort of suggests that redemption is something that, yes, we've been given, but we're now living into every day. I think that's how Christians might think about it. So right now is just one moment of embracing our redemption, of turning toward God, preparing ourselves for the new creation that isn't right now, but is yet to come. And the title itself, and again, his discussion of learning and growth seems to recognize that. It was a little bit that resonated with my understanding of redemption. Did anything in the set resonate for you that way? Any moment or any bits that he gave that you could see as possibly being redemptive?
I had a hard time with this one, to be perfectly honest. I think I appreciated what he was trying to do, but so much of the time when he was getting more introspective and more thinking about how we are all terrible people and we all do terrible things, I think that he kind of fell a little short because for the most part, he was talking about how we're all terrible people, so we should just sit down and listen to each other. Mm. And it felt very inspirational Instagram post to me more than anything else. And I think that yes, we are all terrible people and we are living in the now and the not yet, and that there is grace that is extended to absolutely everyone. But I think that there are also consequences for the actions that we take. And I think absolutely. That there are consequences for the wrongs that we do to other people. And I think the thing that I have a hard time with is the fact that so often in cases of sexual misconduct, usually the consequences tend to fall on not on the perpetrator, but on the person who has been sinned against. And so I get that he's trying to be a better person. Mm-hmm. I'm having a very difficult time squaring that with the way that he was talking about trying to be a better person.
Okay. So something a little facile maybe in the path forward that he was offering. I can see that. And it goes back to being sure to take everything that's being presented with a grain of salt, knowing that we are just getting his side. What did you think about, somewhat relatedly, he also goes into a bit where he talks about his very first stand-up special And this seemed to me like, well, you're kind of stepping around some landmines here. Obviously, completely different cases with these celebrity figures, but this idea of a celebrity being ensconced in scandal and how we look at them afterwards. He brings up R. Kelly, and he says how in Ansari's first stand-up special, he ended it with this long stretch of praising R. Kelly, and obviously would not do that now. And he gives that as an example of how he's changed, I guess. It's another example of accounting for the past and working toward a better future, but I don't know. Would you say that fell flat for you in a similar way?
It almost felt like he was inviting more discussion of his personal life, honestly, and like how he felt about R. Kelly and about how he felt about his own conduct. And I was kind of frustrated that he brought up R. Kelly and he brought up Michael Jackson, and yet he stayed so surface level about himself. And everyone is entitled to their own private life. I don't know him, and I don't know what he's done personally, and I don't know what he's done in his personal life to make amends, if he has done anything. So still taking it with a grain of salt, sure. I guess, in the other direction.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I felt like he was... I don't know. I didn't like it particularly much. And I didn't particularly like that he kept inviting audience participation in a way that felt couched to invite one particular reaction from the audience without any chance for dialogue. And it is a stand-up show, so there's really not very much back and forth, even though I know that his style is a lot of back and forth and audience participation. But yeah, it felt frustrating, I think.
I can see that. And in a way, it does create a stark contrast between, you know, those celebrity situations and what he had found himself involved in. And there's a way that can be seen as, you know, insulating himself a little bit. Like, whatever may have happened with me, you know, it clearly was not the situation with R. Kelly. And so I can see how maybe it's also a protective measure to do that. You know, I guess... maybe it's not as useful to look at this as saying this was Aziz Ansari's redemption moment. You know, what he presented us here, this performance, is something that marks his complete turning, if we want to look at that. But I do think it's not just people who can be redeemed, but it's also places, it's also practices. Those things can be, you know, essentially saved and turned toward their true purpose too. And I do like how Right Now ends. I like how he closed this show, even though we both may have some, you know, questions about the whole entire thing. At the very end, he takes extra time to say goodbye to the crowd and even says something. I think you alluded to this, Sarah. I saw the world where I don't ever get to do this again. And I do think that's probably an allusion to what really struck him about being called to consider his actions from that scandal. And then he says this, he says, quote, "that old disease, he's dead, and I'm glad." And there's something about that, however you want to read that, however genuine you want to take it, I do think he redeems the standard obligatory thank you and good night that we see in a stand-up act. There is something to me very genuine there, and somehow it helps to balance a little bit the more obligatory opening he gave when he does talk about what happened in 2018. This just felt a bit more genuine and kind of redeeming what could have been a rote goodbye, a moment of self-congratulation, and makes it something genuine and true. Did that part strike you, or were you just kind of glad to be done at that point?
It's funny. I think the thing that actually struck me the most about it was the camera work, because for the most part, the special is filmed from an angle that's on stage, like we're standing on stage with him, even for the audience participation moments.
Yes.
And at the very end, the camera went down in with the audience. It was pretty subtle, but a lot of it was just a low angle up at people's faces as they were thinking about the fact that Aziz saying goodbye is something that is usually rote, but probably shouldn't be. On that front, yes, absolutely. I'm still a little frustrated by some of the more surface level sentiments that he was expressing, but I do like the way that he took the time to actually consider what it means to say goodbye and what it means to say thank you and goodbye, and to consider what would happen if I never did this again.
Yeah. Yeah, probably one of the moments that I did resonate with the most. And we should mention, you're talking about the camera work. The director is Spike Jonze here. So, you know, a huge name to do a Netflix stand-up special like this. He made My Beloved Where the Wild Things Are. And most recently, the Joaquin Phoenix sci-fi romance techno fairy tale, Her. It starts with Ansari on the street, very close to him, following him, and then walking into the studio from a stage door where the crowd is all there waiting, which again is an interesting way to do it, but also somewhat self-serving in kind of ushering him into this very warm, inviting, safe space where he's able to eventually kind of address, maybe dance around in some insightful ways, but maybe some frustrating ways too, what happened about a year and a half ago. Anything else you think worth talking about in terms of the special, Sarah?
Well, I mean, I feel like I've been coming down fairly hard on him. And at the very least, I do want to acknowledge that change and redemption is a process. It's not necessarily a one-time thing. So maybe this is a step in the right direction. Maybe this is the beginning of a change. Maybe there's been a lot of change and we just haven't seen it. And there's no way for us to really fully know that. And I don't think that I even really want to know, because his redemption, I mean, God will be glorified regardless of whether or not I know about it. And so in a way, it is not my problem to fix him. It's God's problem to fix him. And there's nothing else that I can really do about that.
Yeah. And that gets complicated. It's difficult to say about someone we know in our personal lives, but it's complicated in a different way when it comes to someone whose art we've appreciated before or we have an attachment to. And, you know, this touches on some of the stuff we talked about in an earlier TC podcast episode. I think it was episode 5, where we talked about separating the art from the sinner. And Michael Jackson and R. Kelly both came up in that episode. So if listeners are interested in hearing more about that specifically, I'd encourage you to go back and check that episode out. Thank you very much, Sarah. I mentioned at the top that you've written a number of things for us here at thinkchristian.net, but you're going to be taking a writing break. I was sad to hear, because you're going to pursue a larger writing project. It's one I think listeners will be excited about and can kind of put on their calendars to look forward to. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I am in the research stages of a larger project about the concept of evil as it's presented in the Alien films. And by the Alien films, I mean all 6 from 1979 up until 2017 when Alien Covenant came out. So
sounds fantastic.
Really excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah, you should be working with the folks at Real Spirituality on that. And yeah, they're friends of Think Christian as well. So too bad you'll have to take a writing break from us, but excited about that project. And you'll still be able to jump on the podcast from time to time while you're doing that, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And when I'm done with the long-term project, I'll be right back here.
Sounds great. Come on and save me. But don't you save This episode's title has a question mark in it for a reason. Can we say that there's redemption in Aziz Ansari's Right Now or Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? As Sarah suggested, maybe determining that isn't up to us. What we do know is that we need to be saved, just as Amy Mann sings in Save Me, which comes from the Magnolia soundtrack, by the way, another movie that does touch on redemptive themes. And we know that Christ's work on the cross has redeemed us. Now it's our opportunity to live into that the best we can. I want to thank Sarah Welch-Larson and J.R. Forresteros for joining me for this episode. You can find Sarah on Twitter as @DodgyBoffin. J.R. is @JRForresteros. Of course, I'm on Twitter too, Facebook as well. Look for me @LarsonOnFilm. And to keep up with all things Think Christian, @ThinkChristian is where you can find us. Both of the Save Me songs that we sampled by Amy Mann and Queen, those can be heard in their entirety on the Spotify playlist that John J. Thompson put together to accompany this episode. Check that out by searching for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. Quick plug here for a day-long film workshop that I'm going to be leading at the Apprentice Gathering coming up in September. It's going to be Thursday, September 26, to be exact, in Wichita, Kansas, again at the Apprentice Gathering. I'm going to be talking about Movies Are Prayers. That's my book making that exact claim. And then I'll be leading an interactive scene-by-scene breakdown of the original Toy Story as a prayer of confession. So if you want to spend the day discussing film, theology, and Buzz Lightyear with me, you can register at the Apprentice Gatherings website. And we'll link to that on our page for this episode at thinkchristian.net/podcast. Until next time, when I've got a hunch we're going to be talking about Chance the Rapper's new album, The Big Day, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for giving us some of your time. The Think Christian Podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more information. Our executive producer is Stephen Koster, and our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder. Lastly, a note of thanks to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois, which provided the recording space for this episode. Learn more at trnty.edu, and go Trolls.